Hello, this is Rory Groves, and you are listening to a recording from the Grovestead Gathering. We made these recordings to serve as a fundraiser for our own family economy. If you would like to share this or listen to other recordings we've made, please visit our website at thegrovestead.com. Thanks for listening.
Let me jump into the subject of today. The title of the little talk here is Fighting the Principalities and Powers. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness. The household and the church, by the way, the first part of this will be a little bit of review. As I noted yesterday, I write these out and read them because I'm going to give them to different people who sponsor the events I speak at, and they can, you know, give them to people who attend it. So if you want the, you know, the manuscripts, they'll be available. But I'm always assuming that each talk is the first time I'm talking to a crowd, so I'm going over a little material here that I went over yesterday in the first part of the talk. The household and the church are always under attack, and you'll see why by the time I'm done, but in our time, the fighting has gotten more intense, and frankly, we're getting kicked around. We need to get back on the offensive. By the way, when Jesus said the gates of hell will not prevail against it, it wasn't as though we were being attacked by the gates of hell. It's not like, the devil takes the gates of hell and is beating us over the head with the gates of hell. what he meant was is that we are going into hell, and the gates of hell will not prevail in terms of keeping us out. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, that's what we're talking about here. So that's why I wrote the book entitled Household and War for the Cosmos, and getting back into the fight is what that talks about. It was actually something I wrote for a conference, great conference, sponsored by Touchstone Magazine in Chicago. It was at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, I think that was where the conference was. And there was a really like a list of speakers, and all of the talks are online, the videos, or most of them anyway. So if you want to actually see the original talk that this was based on, you can go there. It was a great crowd. We had, there were conservative Roman Catholics, Orthodox guys, meaning the guys with the big beards and the black clothes, and then, a lot of, Protestant folks, mostly Reformed folks. And that was where, actually, Nancy Piercy and Tony Esselin heard the talk, because they were also speakers at the conference. And so they, after they gave my talk, they said, you really ought to write a book about that. So I did. So that's how it got started. So let's review a few things about households. We live in a time when you can't do this too much. Besides, it will help me show you how our households are part of the war for the cosmos. Now, just imagine a world without business corporations. Let that sink in. There once was a world without business corporations. For a long time. Or social welfare agencies. No Social Security, no Department of Child Protection Services or anything like that. Nothing like that. Where do you suppose people made a living and got help when they needed it? In their households. That's where. And that's the way it was for the entire course of human history up until about 150, 200 years ago. So what we live in is the exception. Let that sink in. This is the exception, not the rule, not the norm. By the way, when I speak to folks from, say, the third world about these things, or even people in Latin America or Southeast Asia, they all get it immediately. Why? Because this is the universal institution. The household is something that's everywhere. The only way you get away from it is if you become hunter-gatherers. If you want to live like a hunter-gatherer, fine. Good luck. But in terms of, established, agricultural civilizations, no matter where you go, the household is the basis of it. So, I was in a church in New Jersey, in Jersey City, and all the people in the church were immigrants. And when I arrived, I was informed that all the men had read Man of the House. All the guys did. And they all came up to me and said, this is the way I grew up. This is the way things work in Puerto Rico or Mexico. Or in fact, one of the guys was introduced to me as the man of the house. He said, this is the guy that should have been on the cover. So I said, okay, cool. Tell me about yourself. He's a Mexican guy. Came to the United States, didn't speak any English. He's a multimillionaire today. He owns a contracting company. He owns a house in Florida. He owns a house in New Jersey. All of his sons work for him in the business. And he said, yeah, I read the book. That's the way I did it. So anyway, something to keep in mind. So the reason was the household was an economy. Household economies were based on some productive enterprise, usually farming or trade. Sometimes they were subsistence economies. In other words, you just made what you needed to live. And other times they produced goods for the market. But either way, they were nearly the only industry. The only way you had like large-scale projects was through, you know, like slaves on a vast scale. That's what the book of Exodus is about, right? So either way, they were nearly the only, they produced food, clothing, and just about everything else. And on top of that, they were social welfare agencies, educating the young and caring for the elderly. Now, the word economy, as I noted yesterday, is derived from two Greek words, oikos, meaning house, and nomos, meaning law. So an economy is the law of the house. It directed its members toward a common good. That's the thing. It was about a common good, not dad's ego necessarily, as we're told today it was, you know, designed to serve. It wasn't that. It was the common good that everyone was interested in promoting, common good of the people in the house. And this means that a household wasn't a building, it was an authority structure. So there's a structure. And that's why a father's authority in antiquity was unquestioned. People depended on him for so much, life without him was hard to imagine. He adjudicated household disputes. In a world where the police were never just a phone call away, he defended and enforced its boundaries. By the way, in Oikonomikos, that dialogue that I've mentioned a couple of times, Xenophon, you know, it's a dialogue with Socrates. So Plato wasn't the only person who wrote dialogues with Socrates. Xenophon was also a student of Socrates. In that, he contrasts two households and two householders, heads of house. One is a failure. So he says, you know, your house is going down. And he talks to you, you know, talks about why. And that's an interesting conversation. But the other conversation is with a successful householder. And one of the things that you learn in the course of that book is that it was the regular practice of heads of house to practice the martial virtues. Why? Martial virtues meaning swordsmanship, you know, horsemanship, these different things. Why? Because he defended the household. He physically, with his fellow household heads, you know, you didn't send your kids out to do it. You didn't send out the slaves to do it. The heads of house were the ones who fought. So you think you could respect that? Of course you would. You know, that's the guy that's defending you. So he spoke for household interests in public forums. Remember The Patriot by Mel Gibson? Worked just like that. Worked just like that. His job was to govern his household and represent it to the larger community. So a father was so important, his untimely death often led to what? Breaking up the house. Sending people off to his relations. Somebody's got to take you in. So a father gave a household its vertical dimension, but verticality didn't begin or end with him. Fathers were subject to higher authorities. They were like the centurion that Jesus commended for saying, I am a man under authority. You could say that they were actually the middle managers of the cosmos. They weren't at the top. They were somewhere very close to the bottom. There were a lot of authorities above them that they answered to. So this brings me to the most important duty of a father. He represented his household in a cosmic hierarchy. Remember Job? What did he do? He made sacrifices for his children, even though they were grown and moved out, you know, and doing their own thing. Why? Because he was afraid that they had sinned. You know, when he said, better make sure that their sins are atoned for, I'll make sacrifice. So heavenly laws were the basis of the household economy, and the welfare of the household depended on the blessings of heaven. So a father was embedded in a structure he did not invent, and he had responsibilities that he did not choose. And as you know, things at home are very different today. Our households are not economies in the old sense. You know, I've said this before, they're more like recreation centers. And we've outsourced, you know, productive enterprise to the workplace, and when it comes to family welfare, now the young, the old, the sick, and the out of work all depend on social service agencies. There's a great film by the way, that really places this, you know, on, you know, in view, called Avalon. It's about a Eastern European Jewish family that immigrates to the United States, actually to Baltimore. Why they went to Baltimore, I don't know, but they go to Baltimore. And in that film, there's this great sort of sequence where the oldest brother comes over, and then he establishes a business. And the business is paper hanging. And then he saves up money to bring over his brother. So now it's two guys. They save the money, bring over the third. There's five brothers. So they all get over it. Then it's time for the wives and kids. They save, sent, bring over the first bunch, second bunch, third bunch. So now they're all here, and they own like an entire block of brownstones in Baltimore. You know, these houses that are like right next to each other, you know, just contiguous. And it's time to bring over the papa. This is like a big, big deal. You know, the papa. The papa comes, and he, apparently the mother is no longer alive, but he arrives on the boat, and the big family, you know, there's like, you know, 50 people, you know, 60 people waiting, you know, at the dock for this, the papa. And all the kids have this image in their minds of this enormous man, because he's you know, talked about all the time. He's legendary in their minds, and he comes off the boat. He's like 4'5". This little guy, right into the family. And so he comes in, and he lives with the kids. He just goes from house to house, kind of. It's just your turn, it's your turn, it's your turn. And then when they would come home every day, the sons would make a contribution to the father. And he would literally sit out on the porch in the film, and he just has a cup. And all the sons put money in the cup. And the thing that they took great pride in is that their father never had to drink water. He never had to drink water! You know, he's drinking vodka on the step all day long. So, and then the way the film ends is the oldest son, Sam, is in the nursing home. No one visits. That's how the film ends. So you see in the course of just, you know, that, you know, one generation, two generations, you go from that to that. There you go. Progress. Progress. So it's a fun family film, by the way. It really is. It's a film. Who's the guy? Elijah Wood? I think Elijah Wood plays one of the sons in the film. And it's kind of, actually, he's the only grandchild who understands, you know, what's happened. And so you see it from his perspective. So one of the unexpected consequences of all this has been a downgrade in the father's authority. It was not unexpected to Marx. Karl Marx saw it coming, and he thought it was a good thing. So bringing this all home, without a point of reference by which a father and husband can be said to represent a higher authority, households are little more than networks of emotionally satisfying relationships, as I've said already. Now, marriage is justified solely on that basis. So, you know, Tim Keller, I don't know if you're familiar with him, he wrote a book on marriage. I've never read it, but I've been told that in that book on marriage, children are mentioned once. It's like a 300-page book. So what is the marriage for, then? It's about the people who are in it and, you know, their happiness, I guess. I hope I've not done too much violence in your minds with regard to that book. I'm not planning to read it. I've got a lot of things to read, and so I don't have much time, so I try to read things that I think will be helpful to me. So when it comes to raising children, though, fatherhood has been repurposed. Now dad's a buddy, and the goal of this friendship is nurture and happiness for the child, as in I just want him or her or it to be happy. And consequently, the idea that you are duty-bound to your family is now passé. Duty can't be reduced to emotionally satisfying relationships. Duty impresses a structured hierarchy onto our lives. Duty never says, you do you. You do you. Or do what makes you happy. Duty says, this is who you are. Do what's required. It's amazing, though, you know, I've been in many settings like this. That's a very stirring thought and a very inspiring one, but it's one that our culture has completely lost. But no matter where I go, when I mention these things, people are like, yeah, I want to live for something that matters, that requires sacrifice, where I know that you know, what I'm doing is important, not just completely wrapped up in my own personal bliss. Now, some people think that the changes that have occurred are all for the better, that old-fashioned households have been replaced by an open floor plan with plenty of room for personal freedom. And the people who think that way say that Christianity must adapt or die. But there are two problems with that. First, the freedom that these people celebrate is an illusion. We're more servile than ever, and that's because we are more vulnerable than ever. We're more vulnerable to the things that are going on in our culture, and as a result, our institutions are now so large and we're so small, we're like little interchangeable cogs in vast machines, and we feel powerless before them, and often we really are, at least in one sense. But the other problem is that historically the household with its hierarchy and its roles and duties was the very center of the Christian faith. And in case you haven't guessed, I think we need to bring the old household back, at least in some form, adapted for our time. I think that probably, we're going to have some kind of hybrid, retaining the best of the industrial economy. I'd like to keep all those good things. I like air conditioning. I like to keep it. But trying to recover the best of what we lost. Now, there are things about the past that I don't necessarily want to bring back. Hauling water, things like that. So I'm longing for the best of both worlds. Some people might think I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. Anyway, now for the second way, we need to recover a larger frame of reference to build our houses in. We need to get back to the cosmos. Now, when people use the word cosmos today, they tend to use it as a synonym for universe. But the words don't actually convey the same idea. The word universe stresses the singleness of reality, uni, and then verse for turning. So it's something that turns as a whole. That's what universe actually means. And that's a fine word, and even though we've forgotten its meaning, and similarly, most people have no clue when it comes to the origins of the word cosmos. One of the reasons is pop science. You can see what I'm talking about by watching an old PBS television series actually entitled Cosmos. Anybody remember that? Carl Sagan? So I can remember when it came out, and it was like a big event, and it was like a coming out party for celebrity atheist and scientist Carl Sagan. So he was sort of like, the new atheist of his day, if you could think of, who I'm talking about, people like Christopher Hitchens and so forth. He was sort of like that guy in the early 80s. Now, Sagan revealed the agenda that informed the series when he famously intoned in the introduction, "The cosmos is all that is or was or ever will be." You can see him right now on the beach. I don't know if you remember that. He's like standing on a rock. And our feeblest contemplations of the cosmos stir us. There is a tingling in the spine, a catch in the voice, a faint sensation as if a distant memory of falling from a height. We know we are approaching the greatest of mysteries. Now, it's a clever opening, and we should give him credit. But we should also note he plagiarized it. It's an echo of the words of Christ in the book of Revelation. "I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty." And also that reference to a distant memory is a very subtle allusion to amnesis, which is the doctrine of recollection. So he's actually drawing on Plato as well. Falling from a great height, it's kind of almost a Gnostic image. Anyway, but we should also hear an echo of the Apostle Paul from Ephesians. Cosmos is a Greek word, and it's used in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 4. And you wouldn't know what it actually means by the way it's translated with the English word world. Now, the actual verse I'm thinking about, "He chose us in him before the foundation of the world." That's how it's rendered in the ESV. It's a shame because the word world doesn't have the same connotations as the word cosmos had in the first century. When we say world, we generally mean the earth, or this place, But we can be grateful that the ESV does use the original word in the 12th chapter, or I'm saying, sorry, the 6th chapter, 12th verse of Ephesians, where it takes an adjectival form, cosmic. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness. So this brings me back to the origin of the word cosmos. In the first century, it was a way of seeing things that Christians and their pagan neighbors actually shared. So that means that even pagans saw the cosmos differently than Carl Sagan did. The cosmos was more than matter in motion for them. It was an ordered thing, the largest order of them all. That's actually what the word cosmos means, an order. It included everything, even invisible things, and it housed microcosms. The word microcosm is intended to convey the idea there's a macrocosm and then there's a microcosm, the microcosm being the mirror image of the macrocosm. So little orders that depend upon the larger order for their existence. Fractals kind of work in the same way. Like you can think of a tree as a fractal. Are you familiar with fractals? So a tree is a fractal, or a series of, you know, it's basically fractaled. So you've got obviously a trunk and then branches, and branches mirror the sort of the larger structure of the tree, and then, you know, on the trunk, you know, branch, you've got twigs and they mirror the larger structure of the branch, and then you've got leaves even. Even the leaves mirror the larger sort of, you know, structure of the tree. So it works in that way, fractally. And that's something we see all over the place in the natural order. Mathematically, we live in a sort of fractal universe. And households relate to the macrocosm in the same way. It's a fractal, or a smaller version of the macro. So now, there is something ironic about the way we use cosmos today, because in a real way, what we mean by it, it's almost the exact opposite of what it meant in the first century. When Sagan insisted that cosmos is all there is, he explicitly rejected the ancient view that an order depends on an order giver, someone who gives the order. Instead, Sagan tried to explain how matter orders itself without the benefit of intelligence. Now, there were ancient philosophers who entertained the same idea, but they were just a tiny minority, even in the world of philosophy. They were more or less dismissed as nutcases. But some people in the past, though, believe that the cosmos took its present form through a violent process. And you see this all over the world in various mythologies. In those stories, one set of gods fights to impose an order on chaos. But in biblical cosmogony is the word for the making of an order, it's different in important respects from these other creation stories. For one thing, it's not a violent process, but proceeds in a much more workmanlike way. But it is what biblical cosmology has in common with all the others that I want you to see. When it came to the cosmos, Christians and their neighbors agreed that there is someone on top giving orders. That's what they agreed on. Guess what they disagreed on? Who? That was the debate. Who? So verticality. Speaking of the heavens, the ancient cosmos always had a top. Time for a little more political incorrectness. The word hierarchy is a good word. It means sacred order. Hieros for sacred, arche for order. Hierarchy is a sacred order. Now, obviously, you know, you can have rotten people, you know, taking advantage of their place in a hierarchy and using other people. That's a different matter. But the hierarchy itself is a good thing. So even today, we know in our bones that an order must come with a top. Being high means that you have what? Oversight. That's what it means to be an overseer. You're higher in the hierarchy so you can oversee the people who are subject to you. And being low means looking up to your rulers, as when someone says of someone he admires, "I really look up to him." You know, speaking metaphorically, but also reflecting this reality I'm talking about here. So Sagan's cosmos doesn't come with a top. There's no normative vertical dimension whatsoever. It's just space, as in outer space. And paradoxically, this means Sagan's cosmos is flat. Because without verticality, it's impossible to make meaningful distinctions or say that some things are more important than other things. Sagan, who liked to wax poetic, was known for referring to his viewers as star stuff. I don't know if you remember that. You are star stuff. That's my best Carl Sagan impression. But just why that should be a compliment goes unexplained, because rocks and frogs are star stuff too. We're all star stuff. The floor is star stuff. The fan is star stuff. Why should I be flattered by being called star stuff? There's no flattery at all. What this reveals is that the only way Sagan's cosmos can have any charm at all is by sneaking a little of the old cosmos in here and there, cheating. According to the old way of seeing things, stars are a lot more than stuff. We see that when we read books like Voyage of the Dawn Treader. How many folks have read Voyage of the Dawn Treader? So you know that in that book there's a little version of Carl Sagan named Eustace. Eustace Clarence Scrub. That's a great name. I think there's an assonance playing. Useless, Eustace. I think that's kind of what it's sort of what Lewis is up to with the name. But anyway, so he remarks, or he says, when he meets a star in person, you remember that? I think it's Ramadou, that's the name of the star. In our world, a star is a huge ball of flaming gas. To this, the star replies, even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of. Think about how that applies to you as well. You know, I could just say, you're a bundle of biochemical reactions. You're just like a machine made of meat. I've actually heard that kind of terminology in places like Harvard. So, but is that really what you are? Or just what you're made of? Huge distinction. And we have all of this in Ephesians. We have heavenly places. You know, I can give you a series of verses. And if you read Ephesians with this sort of thing in your mind, you'll be reading Ephesians as people in the first century read it or heard it read. There are regions below. And Christ has traveled the intervening span. So he's come from on high down to the world below. He's descended into Hades. He's, you know, ascended into heavenly places again, and now is seated at the right hand of the Father. So now it's this intervening span that we should be interested in, because first of all, it's a problem. There are a number of places in Ephesians where we're told it's a problem. And second, it's because we live there. This is where we live. We live in this intervening span. We live in Middle Earth. Now you know where Tolkien got the idea. Middle Earth. This is Middle Earth. But at our level, actually it comes from Midgard in the Norse, Yggdrasil, the world tree. Anyway, I'll talk about that this afternoon, as we'll be talking about Tolkien. But at our level, we're not the only occupants. Surrounding us are the principalities and powers. So when people ask me, do you believe in extraterrestrial intelligence? Yes, it's in the Bible, right here in Ephesians. Extraterrestrials, right? You know, intelligent creatures who are not humans, principalities and powers. So we're surrounded by these. And we're not just talking about City Hall when we talk about principalities and powers. Actually, Paul uses he calls their chief the prince of the power of the air. I've never met a politician who refers to himself or herself that way. I just have met politicians who behave that way. But it's a great moniker, though, because it gives the sense that we are surrounded, immersed by a spirit who is real but invisible, the prince of the power of the air. The air is that substance that fills the middle span. You know, at the very height, you know, you've got ether, you have the air, then the earth. So anyway, prince of the power of the air. So this middle area is where we are subject to the prince. The problem with this layer of the cosmos is that its prince is insubordinate. The layer we live in is like a province ruled by an ambitious and corrupt governor. And people living in it don't necessarily know that, though they feel the effects every day. According to Paul, though, this layer of the cosmos will eventually be brought to heel beneath the feet of Christ. Every knee shall bow, every tongue confess, right? Now, why are we losing? Why are we losing today? Or at least it seems like we are. First of all, you know, before I get into this, appearances can be deceiving. Sometimes things look like they're really bad, but actually we're on the cusp of something really great. Today, most Christians write off Paul's words about principalities and powers as if they were mere poetry. Isn't that great how Paul waxed poetic there? And that's if they think about it at all. Oddly, many Christians even agree with Sagan that the cosmos is a meaningless place. So, you know, we don't have people asking just basic questions. What is the meaning of our bodies? Apparently, they're just, you know, Play-Doh that we can mold into any shape we please. I've been in Christian circles where that's the assumption. So that's just not acceptable. It not only downgrades the cosmos, it doesn't even do justice to poetry. I think poetry actually is a much more important thing than most of us think it is. When the light of Christ's glory appeared in the first century, it revealed to pagans that there was really nothing to the old gods. But Christ's glory also filled the empty spaces, and the church moved in and grew. Christians cleaned house. Christianity became a very capacious and vibrant place. And beneath its soaring heights, represented, I think, by the Gothic cathedrals, new things were built. Things that had never been seen before. Universities, hospitals, and the greatest civilization the world has ever known. Now, that doesn't mean that it didn't have its faults, its sins, its, you know, horrific moments. But let's keep this thing in perspective. Show me someplace else better. Where would you rather live? Islam? Well, there are people right now that are falling off of planes trying to get away from that. Now, as I noted, it wasn't heaven on earth. And I think we've been led to believe that, you know, advances in science have destroyed that civilization. But it wasn't the telescope that did it. It's atheism. Atheism is a way of seeing that doesn't see. Atheists tell us that there's no intrinsic meaning to things because there's no God to give them meaning, no God who's made them. Some atheists were urbane. Others were violent. And I think of an urbane atheist, I would think of someone like maybe Shaw. You know, if I think of, say, a violent atheist, I think of someone like Lenin. If I thought of like someone who was sort of a popularizer, I think of like H.G. Wells. You know, so there have been a lot of different people, and some of them have been, you know, people that you could have been on friendly terms with. There are others that you wouldn't have wanted to be around. But they all agreed, in the end, everything amounts to nothing. That's it. At first, the fools rose in applause because they believed there's nothing above, we can rise. But wiser fools, and I'm using the term fool here in the sense that we see in Scripture, the fool says in his heart there is no God. The wiser fool, and there have been many wise fools, know, someone like Nietzsche, for example, if there's no heaven, there's no up. No up. It's just matter in motion. Things happening. Things moving but going nowhere. Outer space swallows everything but is never full. And now we have philosophers who say things like, here's Peter Singer from Princeton, a boy is a pig and a pig is a boy. No way to make a distinction. And consciousness itself offends our brightest light. Here's Bertrand Russell in 1903 in a private letter. Quote, I have been merely oppressed by the weariness and tedium and vanity of things lately. Nothing stirs me. Nothing seems worth doing or worth having done. The only thing that I strongly feel worthwhile, get this, would be to murder as many people as possible, so as to diminish the amount of consciousness in the world. These things have to be lived through. There's nothing to do about them. And that was before two world wars. I'm just scratching the surface on the nihilism of our intellectual class. Now, The war for the cosmos today. The empty cosmos of the atheists has left us empty. Empty places don't stay empty for long, though. The cosmos is being repopulated. We're perhaps in a period of tremendous religious ferment right now, one of the biggest in a long time. Jesus told a little story in Matthew chapter 12, verses 43 through 45. When the unclean spirit has gone out of a person, it passes through waterless places seeking rest, but finds none. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when it does, or when it comes, it finds the house empty, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and brings with it seven other spirits more evil than itself. And they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that person is worse than the first. So also will it be with this evil generation. Now, what's interesting to note about that is Lewis, in one of his essays, C.S. Lewis, noted that it would be a lot easier for us to convert the pagans of antiquity than the pagans of our own time. This is actually worse in certain ways than the first time around. But just because you can't see something doesn't mean it isn't there. The prince of the power of the air is as real as you or me, and like air, you can't see him, but you can still feel the effects of his misrule, and the world is sinking into chaos. So we need to relearn the practice of waging the peace. Now, there are many paradoxes in our world, and one of those is if you want peace, prepare for war. Now, the Romans understood that, and the Pax Romana, peace of Rome, dealt with the situation on the ground. And when it came to troops on the ground, they were tough to beat. The Jews tried and lost badly. The Roman war wagon just pacified them by rolling right over them. But before that, Rome had brutally gotten its own house in order. The Republic had been constitutionally incapable of keeping the peace over the vast territory it ruled. We're kind of going through the same phenomenon in our own world today. Standing armies, get this, were financed directly by their generals. Caesar had his own personal army. Guess who they were loyal to? Caesar. Ptolemy, same deal. Augustus, same deal. Anyway, civil war had been practically inevitable. In the end, Augustus defeated his rivals. And from that point on, there was no going back to the old way of doing things. From the perspective of the people on the ground, that was a good thing. The triumph of Augustus was celebrated in works of art, among them Gemma Augustae, a carving dated from the second or third decade of the first century AD. That's a very important time frame because it's not long before Paul wrote Ephesians. The gem shows Augustus seated in a heavenly place, surrounded by the gods. We know they're the gods because we've got, you know, Neptune with his trident, got Athena with her helmet, you know, surrounded by the gods. He is divine. I hope you see what that implies about the Christian or the peace of Christ. Christians believed that Christ is Lord in the same way that Romans believed that Augustus was Lord. Christ made rebellious authorities submit. And that was why he is now seated in a heavenly place. And he governs a capacious household where former enemies live together in peace. Now you get the whole, you know, sort of imagery of, you know, you who are far off and you who are near. The dividing wall of hostility has been taken down. We live together in peace in the house of God. Now, what the peace we're fighting for looks like. Augustus commissioned Virgil, the greatest poet of the time, to compose an epic that told the story of the founding of Rome and why it was destined to rule the world. It was called the Aeneid, and its protagonist was none other than the Trojan hero Aeneas. The Romans, by the way, believed that they were descended from the Trojans. This is one of those kind of open secrets that folks don't really understand. It was like when they went over and conquered the Greeks, it was like, ha, 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 finally, you know, finally revenge. That's the way they thought about it. They deeply identified with the Trojans. And according to the legends, the city of Rome was founded by Aeneas. Now, later come, you know, Romulus and Remus, they're descended from Aeneas. Now, the Jews had their own epic, and it's found in the Bible, and it begins with the story of Abraham. And the Jews also believed that they were heirs of the world. So the Romans believed that they were the heirs of the world, and the Jews believed that they were the heirs of the world. Guess what this means? There was only room in this town for one heir. Draw. And anyway, so that was the nature of the conflict at its deepest level. But there is another similarity between the stories of Aeneas and Abraham. Both end with a marriage. In the Aeneid, Aeneas waged war for a princess. So they arrive in Italy. There's a kingdom there. And arrangements are made for this king's daughter to marry Aeneas, which would make Aeneas heir to the throne. There's another community. There's another sort of interested party by the name of Turnus. This leads to a battle, a big conflict. And this is the very end of the Aeneid. And in that story, Aeneas kills Turnus at the very end. But the story never ends. It's an unfinished work. This is one of the things that's really, I think, intriguing from a Christian point of view. He doesn't actually get to marry her in the story. We actually know that that's what's supposed to happen next, but we don't actually see the wedding. And when Virgil was on his deathbed, he asked for the Aeneid to be burned. He didn't want it to survive because he didn't have a chance to finish. So he just literally wanted to have it. Guess who intervened? The emperor. Don't. That's the national story. That's our epic. I paid a lot of money for that story. He actually did. So he was going to keep it. And in the ancient world, in the first century, there was stuff from the Aeneid that was like graffiti on the walls. It was so well known. If you read, The City of God by Augustine, he's quoting from the Aeneid all over the place. So anyway, and the first century Christians knew all about it. And we have plenty of evidence in the New Testament to that effect. Ephesians reflects that. But also in Acts, you remember the conversion on the road to, Damascus, right? Paul, chapter 9 of Acts, right? Next chapter, chapter 10, we switch back to Peter. And there's this really fascinating episode between the conversion of Paul, who would become the apostle to the Gentiles, and Peter in Cornelius' house, a Roman centurion who would have known all about the Aeneid and the story of Aeneas and would have identified himself as a son of Aeneas, a descendant of Aeneas. That household, in between those two stories, is the healing of a guy named, guess what? Aeneas. And he can't walk, which is like a joke. It's like an inside joke, because in the Aeneid, when Aeneas escapes the burning city, as the city is burning down all around him, guess who he has on his back? His father, who can't walk. His father's a cripple. So he's got his father on his back and his son by the hand and his sword in the other hand. He's literally fighting his way out of the city to save his heir and his father. So now we have Aeneas on a mat and he can't walk. What's that intended to say? The empire is sick, really sick. And guess who's going to heal it? Christ. Aeneas, stand and walk. Stands up. Anyway, a little background there for you. So, Abraham's story ends in remarkably the same way, albeit he's not the one who wages the war for the queen. That's the job of his heir, the son of David. After he wins the greatest victory of all, he wins his bride, and the bride ends, the Bible ends, I should say, with their wedding day. And they lived happily ever after. Revelation chapter 21. That's it. The church is the bride. So this gets to the matter you brought up yesterday, the relationship between the church and the household and all of that. It all ties together. And that brings us back to the household. So the Christian household is more than just an economy, just a way of living and making a living. Because if that's all there were to it, then the modern economy, this brave new world that we're creating for ourselves, well, maybe it really is inevitable and we should just sort of like lay down and let it just have its way. But that's not all there is to it. We glimpse the more in one of the most politically incorrect passages that Paul ever wrote, Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23. There he says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband, pardon me, is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Now here's the key phrase, key sentence. This mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. But that phrase, this mystery is profound. Now, when we hear the word mystery today, we think Sherlock Holmes, right? You know, deer hunter cap, pipe, you know. It's a puzzle that gets solved. The mystery has been solved. That's what we say. The mystery is solved. That's the way modern people think about mysteries. Mysteries are puzzles that we solve. But in the Bible, the Greek word mysterion doesn't convey that at all. The Greek word mysterion means that there's something hidden inside something else. There's something hidden in the relationship of a husband and wife becoming one flesh that actually reveals the end of the world. That's the thing. So our marriages tell a story. The story is what I'll get to in a minute. So anyway, let's see, where was I? Okay. The nexus of the Christian household, as you know, is the union of a husband and wife. And in both Genesis and Ephesians, we're told that it makes them one flesh. Paul tells us that this is a mystery, meaning, as I noted, it hides something even as it reveals something. One flesh begins with a conjugal union. That's why it was once called consummating a marriage. But it's just the beginning. One flesh also refers to the natural issue of that union in children. And it goes even beyond that. It's a union of interests and goods in a common life. The legal term for that, by the way, is joint tenancy. This means that what goes for one goes for the other. And Paul tells us that all of this applies to Christ and the church. What belongs to the church belongs to Christ, and what belongs to Christ belongs to the church because they are one flesh. So the new covenant helps to make this connection. Here's why. Because sinners are condemned to die, Christ died for his chosen bride. And because Christ was raised and glorified, guess what? The church is raised and glorified too. We call this double imputation in the Reformed tradition. And that's a form of moral accounting. Presbyterians love accounting. We're real good at that kind of thing. But what it accounts for is the one flesh union of Christ and the church. And I hope you see what that implies when it comes to the Christian household. It means that in a real way, the Christian household is a picture of the end of the world. What I mean is it shows us the purpose of the world, the cosmos. And it shows us what the new world, Cosmos 2.0, will look like. It's a sign that reads, "This is the way the world will end. Not with a bang or even with a whimper, but with wedding bells." The glorification of the church. I want to talk about guerrilla piety now. There's a war going on and you've been conscripted and given your armor in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 13 through 20. Now, I want to think about this a little bit because oftentimes when preachers address the armor of God, you know, they're kind of like J. Vernon McGee. You remember J. Vernon McGee? Was it Bible Answer Man? Was it J. Vernon McGee. You know, talk like that. I liked him a lot. But when he got to Ephesians chapter 6, I think he just completely missed it. I remember the episode. There was Paul in prison, and he looked over and saw a Roman centurion, and he thought, "What a great illustration.
I will now take the virtues that we enjoy in salvation and apply them to the different pieces of armor. No. It's kind of like an afterthought, you know. Well, I've talked about really important things over here, so I'm kind of mopping up now, and let me just throw this at you. I actually think the whole thing leads to this. It's the whole point. It's kind of getting you to the point. You have been conscripted into a war. Every one of us in Christ is a soldier. And this actually parallels the giving of the armor of Aeneas to Aeneas by his mother Venus. That's always been a lot of fun to think about. Imagine, your mother is Venus. Wow. Hi, Mom. But in the story, she gets Hephaestus, or Vulcan, to make armor for her son, which is really weird because this was a tryst that she, you know, Aeneas is the result of an affair. You know, she has a tryst with a human, and Vulcan is actually her legal husband. But she gets, you know, him to make armor for her boy so that he's going to win because she really loved him. So anyways, you know, the armor is made. One of the most important features or pieces of armor that Aeneas is given is his shield. And the shield is emblazoned with all of the victories yet to be experienced by the Romans. In other words, it's a prophecy. The shield is presented as, this is the story of our people going forward. We will rule the world. And in the course of the story, there's another interesting episode where Aeneas actually goes into the underworld, because during the course of the journey from Troy to Italy, his father dies, so he is in the underworld, and Aeneas is given the ability to go and visit his father. And his father is the one who gives him the charge. And the charge is basically, your job is to rule the world. You know, let the Greeks make pretty statues. You become really the statesman, the warrior, you know, and your task is to pacify all of the peoples of the world and unite them into one empire. That's your job. So that was the vision. And actually, Augustine, his name for Augustus, quotes from that passage in the City of God and in Confessions. Anyway, so this is in the back of everyone's mind. So Christians have been given their armor, much like Aeneas was given his armor, to go out and fight. But it's a spiritual fight. We wage, you know, our war not against flesh and blood like the Romans do. Our battle is with the principalities and powers, the unseen cosmic powers in this present darkness. So there's a war going on. And like Christians in the empire, we're hopelessly overmatched on the ground. The principalities continue to rage against the true rule and Lord of the cosmos. There's inhuman machinery that menaces us. Technology tracks us. Increasingly, it manipulates us. Progressive multinational corporations standardize us. Mainstream media seek to indoctrinate us. State-run education and healthcare make us ever more dependent on government largesse. And all of these things and more are arrayed against us. Yet, in spite of all these things, Christ has already won. Why is that? Because he defeated death. What's the worst thing that can happen to you? Die. Christ defeated death. We win. So we know the end of the story. We win. And it's because Christ defeated the final enemy. I had a friend years ago when I was involved in urban ministry in Boston. He was he worked a lot with guys who were in gangs. He was a clerk of the court, and he was also a youth pastor. And one of his favorite sayings whenever he was threatened was this: you can't threaten a man with heaven. What do you got? You know, to live, you know, for Christ is, you know, great, but to die is gain. Now I know that seems like unbelievable. You know, it's hard to sort of really get yourself into that frame of mind, but wouldn't it be great if you could live that way all the time? I'm not there all the time, not by a long shot, but I wish I could be there. So we wrestle with defeated enemies, but there are two strategies that project remarkable influence in the world so long as they are microcosms of Christ's cosmic order. The first has to do with the household of God. how the household of God fits into this. When Alexander the Great swept over the East, and again, this is something that everyone in the first century was very familiar with, he left a trail of cities, 70 cities, bearing his name, Alexandria. What do you want to name it? Alexandria, of course. He did name one for his horse, but the rest, were named Alexandria. Now, it was more than an ego trip, although I'm sure there was a lot of that. They promoted the Greek way of life in the regions of his conquest. So like in the New Testament, we hear about the Hellenists. We're actually talking about Jews who had been sort of, made into Greeks. They weren't actually Greeks, So one of the big conflicts in the early church was between these Hellenized Jews and Jew-Jews, I guess maybe you call them. And there was a big history there. I mean, there was a really ugly history there. And it was very sort of fresh in their minds, and they felt it deeply, this sense that the Hellenists had betrayed the Jewish faith. So the first, converts were, Samaritans and Hellenists, and bringing them into the church was challenging in terms of the, feelings and patriotism of the Jews who had been Christ's disciples. But those were intended to be, like I noted, with Alexander, model communities, gifts of the divine Alexander to help enlighten his subjects, kind of teach them the ways of the Greeks. The churches that Paul planted throughout the Roman world performed the exact same function. In those houses, the stewards of God, the elders, worked to make sure that these communities put the benefits of Christ's rule on display for the principalities and powers. And Paul is explicit about that in chapter 3, verse 10 of Ephesians. And this is what he says. Through the church, the manifold wisdom of God is made known to the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. So in other words, every time we gather for worship, it's not just, the good guys who are looking in. The bad guys are too. And it's intended to just put on display the wisdom of God to God's adversaries. Kind of mockingly, almost. You think you rule the roost down there? Look at those folks over there. It's important to keep these things in mind because when we turn the church into a water boy for secular culture in the name of relevance, we lose touch with the true standard. And there's something of a paradox here. When the church chases the world, it loses it and itself. But when the church chases heaven, it gains the world. So that's the first strategy. Now, the second stratagem is the household. The household is the fulcrum of the world. It gives us leverage, and the principalities know this. That's why they're obsessed with breaking it down. Now, you may wonder how your small stake could possibly threaten the powers that be. Just remember, a household ordered by the household code in Ephesians reflects the rule of Christ, and all things connect. That little tune that your household sings carries. So fight the good fight, go home and build your house, and if you do it the right way, you will give the world a glimpse of things to come. There is nothing more terrifying to the principalities and powers than this. Not smart bombs, not cruise missiles, that. Because in the end, the principalities will bow and confess that Christ is Lord. So anyway, that's that. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to do my best to answer them. By the way, my next talk is going to be on the harmony of the household. And I'm going to be drawing a lot on, Tolkien and Tom Bombadil and Goldberry. So, anyway.
Great. Thank you, Chris.
Sure.
And let's open it up for questions. A few minutes here. Anyone have any questions to follow up on this talk? Household and war for the cosmos. I didn't know that about the cosmos. Order.
Yeah.
It's hard to get away from a divine creator when the meaning of the word is order.
Yeah. I think that's why we've lost touch with that. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
One of the things that when I'm listening to you talk and share some of these things, and with all of the research that you've done and understanding historical context of things, you kind of have a better map, so to speak, than a lot of us do on where we are. And you're seeing, I specifically think about it when you're seeing, let's say, adversaries of the household or the church putting out their propaganda, and then so many Christians are not aware that it's an old playbook.
Yeah.
And but they also, at the same time, they're running their lives, they're living their lives, and they're doing the best they can. They can't sure. possibly consume as much information,
right?
You know, as a well-researched.
That's why my book is very thin.
Okay. So, I mean, what would your advice be to families, you know, just to kind of open our eyes to what's out there? What should we be exposing ourselves to in an efficient manner so that we can stay current on things and kind of see the wiles of the enemy and not get taken captive by it?
Yeah, I guess there are great books out there, but you're right. I mean, it's taken me 30-plus years to be where I am, you know. So now that means that there were a lot of things that I, you know, studied that don't relate to this. But still, you know, because I taught philosophy, you know, for years and have a pretty wide range of, resources to draw on, you know, I have an ability to sort of do this kind of thing, kind of bring it all together. But there are other good books out there. It's just... the challenge is finding the books that are and the resources that are not going to just, you know, require the kind of education that I've got to read. You know, so like, you know, Carl Truman has a book out right now, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. Great book, but I mean, it's a master's level read. You know, you've got to have a really strong background in philosophy and history of Western thought. I think it's a great book. I recommend it to everybody. Don't be discouraged if you read it and say, wow, man, I'm really bogging down here. But in terms of, you know, people who are trying to help people see things, connect things to, you know, one of the things I'm involved with, I'm part of a podcast called the Theology Pugcast. And so I'm with, one of the guys on the podcast has got his PhD from Oxford. Another guy is a Colson Fellow, PhD, and then there's just me. And then every week we talk about different things that are kind of related to sort of cultural developments, and we talk about sort of the historical roots, how these things, you know, sort of came to pass, or how we've come to this sort of the situation that we're in now. So there's that. You know, a guy who I find really helpful, but isn't really known for this, it's not like his thing that he's known for, is Nate Wilson. Nate is a young adult author, but he just has a remarkable ability to sort of get to the heart of things and put things into proper perspective. So for example, he's got a little podcast called Stories Are Soul Food. So yeah, it's a great one. And just here recently he was talking about the, you know, sort of empire and the inevitable, you know, it's decay of the American Empire. It is inevitable. You know, it's not the kingdom of heaven. You know, is there going to be a day when it's gone? You know, so it may not be, you know, for hundreds of years, but eventually it's going to be gone. But his point was, empires when they decay make great fertilizer. So the soil of a decayed empire is where Christians really have an advantage, because we know how to grow stuff. You know. Those guys know how to ruin stuff, but we know how to grow stuff.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris.
Yeah.